Welcome to Season 3, Episode 6 of Context, Views on Crypto and Culture, presented by Boys Club in partnership with Sotheby's Metaverse. And I'm your host, Blake Finucane. This episode is part of Lens Protocol's FWB Fest coverage. Thanks to MP for making this happen. Now, the festival took place in August, but so many of the ideas brought up during that event are things I want to dive further into. So who better to have on than Daisy Alioto, co-founder of Dirt Media, speaker at Fest. The New York Times recently wrote a feature on her. She's very in demand, and she's pioneering new media models with Dirt, which we cover in our combo. We talk about how she sees NFTs not as much as an investment vehicle, but actually as a tool to architect a unique subscriber-publication relationship. And she also highlights why she wants to make media more collectible and how streetwear can be helpful when understanding different drop mechanics and subscription models, as she wants to insert status signaling and the short-term hype cycle into consuming quality media. She genuinely has fresh ideas. She's truly defining a whole new media landscape. We also cover how newsletters have grown and changed, how meme coins have become their own media communities, and how books can be seen as the new handbags. So if you want to get a stronger grasp about where the media industry is headed, particularly digital media, and better understand your own media consumption habits, and how crypto technology can fit into that, this is the episode for you. So let's get into it. I'm so excited to be speaking with Daisy Alioto. Her track record is super impressive, from interning at Elle and NPR to staff positions at the International Business Times, Time Inc., and the New York Review of Books. Her journalism and nonfiction have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, GQ, Vox, and Condé Nast Traveler, among others. And she is currently the CEO and is also the co-founder of Dirt Media. And the company is taking a super innovative approach. I think they're pioneering some new media models at both the organizational and content levels, and they cover a wide variety of cultural topics. I cannot wait to chat about her takes on media and the media business and writing. She's also a great follow on Twitter. So Daisy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. You know, I've been trying to tweet less, but I'm not sure if it's working.
Why have you been trying to tweet less?
Well, it's a decision I made in like the previous vibe, but now that the vibe has shifted, I'm sort of back in. If you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're ready to see and be seen.
Just when I think I'm out, they drag me back in.
That's how it always works.
I don't know if you've experienced this, but I've seen some tweets alluding to it, which is like visible likes went away. Mm-hmm. People started liking sort of guilty pleasure chum. But I do think the things that our friends like are then weighted into our For You page. Like, I think it used to be bookmarks, but now I feel like we're all polluting each other's For You page with our guilty pleasure likes. And I mean like live, laugh, love memes.
I'm getting a lot of like animal videos.
Totally. And like before I would have been like, I don't need to like this. But Now it's like nobody's going to know. And so now everyone else's feed is like, everyone else is like, nobody's going to know if I like this.
And then I feel like I'm learning nothing on Twitter because I haven't seen any of my friends tweet. I'm just seeing what the spooky things that they've all liked.
Very spooky. It
drags me into it. Liking like chimp videos.
Yeah, but now I can like crypto threads without embarrassment.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
My normie friends are getting exposure in their For You page to strong opinions on business development.
Totally. And okay, I wanted to start outside of the Twitter sphere into more generally a question around Dirt. How would you describe Dirt to people who maybe aren't familiar with it?
Fascinating question. So... I mean, I've called us the Condé Nast of newsletters. We have two newsletters right now. We're adding more. But we cover digital culture more broadly, kind of along the thesis that like all culture is digital culture. But we also drill down into specific categories. So the second newsletter we added is about design. It's called Prune. And I also have like a really strong opinion that media companies have become more like lifestyle brands and need to create a culture of collecting, which is how sort of ended up building a media company that had a relationship to Web3. And so also Dirt has some elements of it that are almost like a streetwear company as well, which is sort of like platform agnostic, medium agnostic. Like sometimes we pop up as a perfume, Sometimes we pop up as a print zine. So I think there's actually a lot of synergy with what Boys Club is doing as well. And like we've talked about that before. Our writing is like pretty, it really runs the gamut. There's things that we publish that are very intellectual and could, you know, could be published in the New Yorker. There's stuff that we publish that's like very, very online. I think I'm always trying to cultivate a mix of voices and topics where we're thinking about like the reader who's opening Dirt every day to sort of have their taste shaped. And so thinking about that varied diet of topics where like one day we're telling the untold story behind like a Rauschenberg painting. I know that you have a background in art. And then like the next day we're syndicating something that is explaining the parallels between mischief and meme coins. And that all of these things can fit under one brand umbrella and still feel consistent. That's the sort of like editorial line that I'm like constantly trying to walk.
Love it. And the mischief and meme coins, that was by a former guest named Danny. I think she's the leading voice on digital fashion. It is such a good article, just for those who haven't read it. Okay, I have so many follow-up questions. I am really fascinated in the newsletter business and your thoughts on that. So maybe we can start there. We've seen rise of Substack, the rise of writers leaving journals, whatever, and doing their own thing, building their own followings via newsletters. As I understand it, you really started your media business as a newsletter business. How do you see newsletters in terms of building a media business, the central part that they play? I'd love for you to speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the newsletter Dirt started out on Substack, like before we became a corporation. I think, yeah, Substack and the creator economy, like media personalities striking out on their own is a really big trend. There's also the trend of companies like, I mean, Axios was one of the first. I think the more recent ones are like Puck and Airmail, offering subscriptions to people who want to hear about specific industries and then are able to generate ad revenue from being hyper-targeted towards decision makers. I think there's a lot to learn from that model, and not all of them are B2B. So like Axios and Punchbowl, like I think people and the information, like people paying for those subscriptions are probably paying through their company. Airmail comes more out of the legacy of Vanity Fair. It's not really B2B. We wanted to think about like, how would you get the same amount of money from somebody as like the information? I don't know how much the information is a year. Like, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I think it's at least a couple $100s. So how could you charge that same amount to people that are going to buy it for themselves and not be putting it on a company card and really be like consumer facing? Like, this is not information that you need for your job or your industry. This is information you want as an individual to be a more tasteful and interesting person. And I think you can't charge up front everyone except for maybe your super fans like hundreds of dollars a year, but you could still make hundreds of dollars a year off of a single person if you give them a lot of other stuff to collect. I think the way that we think about subscriptions and even the way that we think about NFTs is like very limiting because, you know, it's like the same thought experiment of like, think about how much you spend on coffee a month and like, you know, how much you would be saving. I think we've all made the decision, like the copy's worth that. But $60 a year, $5 a month to some people doesn't make sense for a subscription, either because they don't want to pay it all up front or they feel overextended into like Netflix and Apple TV and all that other stuff. Or they just came up at a time when like most media was free, which is like understandable. Like, I'm also from that generation. But that same person might buy a $30 hat and a $30 zine, all of a sudden they've paid the equivalent of an annual subscription. So just being smarter about that, like, I think that's where the streetwear thing comes in. What if we stop thinking of people as subscribers and we start thinking about them as collectors? We could create a new class of person who's like a super collector that will buy every single thing that we put out. But we could also take people who will never be paying subscribers and still turn them into having the same lifetime value or annual value as a subscriber, but offering things that they want to buy. And so they might be getting the content for free, but they convert in off of merchandise, or they convert in off of a compelling collaboration. So that's something I'm still constantly thinking about and working through, because it requires resources, right? To be doing that, you can't just turn on subscriptions and set it and forget it. But the fact is, we are seeing the most revenue and growth potential around these collectible moments and collaborations. And so we're planning to lean in more. Our most recent one was around tarot. We produced this interactive tarot deck that could be used within the software platform Moonlight, which is software for tarot readers. So if your business is reading tarot, you can run your business through that instead of needing to use Zoom. Clients can book sessions. If you just want a tarot reading, you can come and book a session. So they have all these digital decks. So we created a custom digital deck that was actually free to use. But we also created a ton of storytelling content around tarot through selecting 5 writers who had tarot readings and wrote something based on their reading. So it's a pretty unconventional editorial approach, I think. And then the next collaboration we're going to do is going to be totally, totally different from that. And I think that novelty and the fact that you're not constrained to one format really appeals to people.
And I think too, how you said moving out of newsletters that are B2B, people are actively subscribing because they want their taste shaped and they want a certain kind mm-hmm. of cultural funnel delivered every day. And I think a lot of times too, the better your taste, the better you're going to do in your job. I mean, maybe arguably the worse your taste, sometimes the better you do in your job. But mm-hmm. I'd like to think that the taste economy is very helpful in how everyone's operating. So I think we'll see more and more crossover there for sure. I want to also talk about, because you've used NFTs as a vehicle to support in funding your company, but also on the editorial side of things. First, maybe on the funding side of things, how have you used NFTs and how helpful has that process been for you?
Well, it was an early crowdfunding mechanism, mm-hmm. back in the first NFT bull market. And I think if that we hadn't been able to crowdfund, we might not have seen the opportunity to get started. I stopped seeing infrastructure or Web3 as totally useful for collector behavior, where we would want the price to go up or rely on the price to go up, and started to see it as more useful as a mechanism for architecting the relationship between the subscriber and the publication. What Dirt has right now is the very MVP version of that, where everyone who has a subscription to Dirt right now technically has a subscription token that represents access for the calendar year. But we've abstracted it a lot away from Web3. So they log in with Privy and they basically stay logged in until they leave their session, which I actually think is an improvement over a lot of sites that make you put
totally.
In your password frequently. And what I like about this is it's allowing us to start to track individual wallets in the way that they interact with Dirt. Privy is rolling out or has rolled out cross app portability now. So previously, if you had a Privy wallet in the environment of Dirt, it would not carry over to Zora. That's changing. So they could be interconnected now. And so I'm looking forward to being able to know more about our subscribers that use Privy across multiple environments. But I will say that the vast majority of our subscribers are not super active in Web3. And I think that's actually been a benefit in some ways, because we're not speaking to a small sector of people. I think having 1 foot in Web2 and 1 foot in Web3 sometimes can give you twice as many challenges. But I also think I've stayed more open-minded to the opportunities around Web3. I've watched it change a lot. I'm still interested in a lot of the experiments that are happening there. I think there's a lot of behaviors in Web3 around financial speculation that can be interesting from a memetic perspective, or if you care about media, understanding how meme coins become almost their own media communities is really interesting and can't be dismissed necessarily, even if the value of the assets is like zero. It shows behaviors that can be interesting if like harnessed in a positive way.
As you said, the reader / subscriber relationship to the publication and how you're using NFTs to architect that. I know that there's certain content things that you're playing around with in terms of organizing the DIRT community and having them engage via crypto rails, but I'd love for you to speak more about that side of how you're using the technology.
Yeah, I think one thing that I like witnessed in my experience in the media industry is like the decline of digital ads and like the quality of them, just in really poor targeting, or, you know, having the experience of like third party ads. Like they follow you around the web, they're not compelling, they're not interesting, and they're responding to like really weak signals on the user's part. So like the example I always use is like the pair of sneakers that you look at and then they follow you around for 3 weeks. And I think the next era of advertising, however long it takes to be put into practice, and I think it's going to be a while until some of this stuff happens at scale, but should and will be more about data that the user controls or voluntarily shares. We'll see more portability of a user's identity between environments, like, you know, moving from HBO to Netflix to some sort of social network to a Discord. And I've heard it described as like a data backpack. Some people think that that's going to be like, that's like the future of what a wallet will be. And so if you believe that, then that wallet or backpack, whatever you want to call it, will have the highest signal information about a user because it'll be stuff that they collected, not just looked at. And so what we've also done is like laid the groundwork for an advertising environment where impressions would be sold against what users have collected rather than what they've looked at. And that sort of environment can only exist adjacent to media because advertising has always existed adjacent to media. Right now, if you wanted to advertise in that way, there's very few environments that you could do it in.
In terms of how you've talked about organizing your company, you've said it's a pathway to having a media brand that operates more off of a streetwear fashion playbook. I'd love for you to go more into that in terms of the actual collectability aspect. And I know you mentioned like whether that's hats, zines, like merch. Do you also see that on the NFT side, like collecting different articles as NFTs? Or how do you see the balance between, I guess, physical merch and then the digital NFT side of things?
I think it's unlikely that the content itself is going to be mintable. Okay. We've had conversations about that. As a writer, I only produce one or two things a year that I think are really collectible. Mm-hmm. I really make a distinction between, like, when Mirror was rolling out article NFTs, like I talked to them about it and I told them I really see a distinction between what makes something readable, what makes it shareable, and what makes it collectible. Definitely been doing some thinking around meme coins as a way of status and signaling belonging, and the way that people signal their interest in certain publications right now is like pretty limited relative to other areas of culture. So like the example I've used before in talking about like making media more collectible, period, not even on chain, is like Vogue and Supreme, obviously brands that have a lot of importance in the culture and super fans. Vogue has an even longer history, obviously, than Supreme. But if you're a super fan of Supreme, there's so much stuff that you can buy to signal that. And with Vogue, you can really only buy the magazine and maybe a couple other things. And like, why is there this balance? And I think meme coins, as like we were saying before, their own sort of media entities, but like media stripped down to literally just like one memetic nugget, show that like you can quickly assemble a ton of momentum around a piece of media. But when is the last time you saw that momentum around a reputable media brand? And part of it is like no reputable media brand is going to sacrifice or risk their credibility for short-term memetic growth. But there are cultural things that do this well, right? Like Brat is an example. And I know Boys Club's written and talked about it. It's not the only example. Obviously, it's the most recent example. Like Barbenheimer last summer, like how quickly we forgot. I'm surprised how few people are mentioning Barbie Pink and Brat Green as like literally just a repetition of what happened the previous summer. I feel like media companies themselves, despite really driving a lot of culture, are kind of missing out on the shorter term cycles, and that it doesn't really have to be either or. Going viral has changed a lot. And part of it is because going viral was really literally part of the monetization model for companies like BuzzFeed and Vice. Those companies have sort of, they're like way past their peak. They're sort of in their like downfall era. And we're building new companies like Dirt. So I'm constantly thinking about like, how can I take my deep experience in magazines, what people loved about them as containers of taste, as, you know, places to assemble and nurture talent, have a deep history, have a really strong cultural perspective, but also recognize that there is opportunity around some of the stuff that like Mischief does with like guerrilla style drops and streetwear culture and hype culture and yeah, even meme coins. And I think it's less about putting everything on chain and more about being really smart in which moments you create momentum around and like using the best available technology and mechanism for people to be able to participate in a way that's meaningful to them. Meme coins, I think, yeah, they're financial speculation, but I think because they got even more shipped back from NFTs, also show a ton of just pure status signaling with no awareness of price. And maybe that's because like everyone who cares about their money just left. But yeah, I think like we have to insert a little bit more of the status signaling in the short term, like hype cycle into consuming quality media. I don't think that they are fundamentally at odds, but nobody's really brought them together before for like this particular era. I think Dirt is like kind of coming the closest, if I could like toot my own horn.
Toot it. I think for the listeners, Mischief, if you're not familiar, the big red boots that everyone wore, and actually Natasha, the co-founder of Boys Club, went viral with a tweet saying that she was going to wear those Mischief boots to a crypto conference. And a lot of the crypto bros didn't understand that that was a joke because, you know, humor evaporates in a lot of crypto Twitter.
These things are hard. These things are hard.
Humor is so nuanced and it's so hard. To follow up on that, a quote that you said in another interview that I'd love to get your further thoughts on, you said, "We might see that magazines are the new handbags. We might see that books are the new handbags." That is a super interesting thought. And I think it goes to status signaling for your favorite cultural publications. But I'd love for you to go into that more.
Yeah, I mean, there's been this like ascendant lit girl summer happening. I think for people in the literary community, like it seems like this has been talked about for a long time, but there's still trend pieces being written about it. Like this was like some inside baseball stuff. But like the picture that was taken of Kendall Jenner reading Tonight I'm Someone Else, which is like my friend Chelsea Hodson's book, that happened like I think almost 5 years ago. At the time, it generated a ton of conversation about how celebrities are able to influence people's like reading habits. But like that moment's been happening for a while. Like the Kendall Jenner book sale boost, like for Chelsea, that happened a long time ago. And Chelsea actually has since founded her own press and put out a book of poems by the person who curates Kendall's reading material.
So there's a reading curator is what you're saying.
For some celebrities, yeah. Or yeah, I mean, and that person might probably has like another job. You know, I think she helps Kendall in other ways, but like she would recommend books to Kendall. That's how the book ended up in Kendall's hands. And then, you know, you have like Dua Lipa, Kaya Gerber, but Reese Witherspoon going back to Hello Sunshine, starting as like a reading club. This isn't like super new, like this idea of celebrity as being kind of like one of the only ways to really launch your book into like rocket ship sales. I think what is new is like younger people and book talk and Gen Z leaning into more like books, like as avatars of their tastes. And I think this comes back to the taste economy, but that doesn't necessarily correlate with like more book sales or the financial issues in the publishing industry, of which there are many, and in the media industry as well, won't necessarily be solved by it becoming cool to take a picture of your book or to have a certain book. And that's why the handbag metaphor is like a little bit more apt because handbags are not something that, like, we don't buy a new handbag every month, right? But the ones that we do buy, we over-index on signaling them, right? Like, they're going to be in a lot of pictures with us. It kind of has, like, a prominent place in our wardrobe. So I think we might see a scenario where people are buying fewer books for more money, or the books that they're buying, they're placing more status weight on them than they have previously. And you might see super consumer behaviors, and I think we already do, where, like, most books are read digitally, but some, if you buy it, the physical thing, you're buying it, the physical thing, for a reason. And you're probably buying the physical thing because the majority of your life is digital. And, you know, it's nice to have things that are like the antithesis of that. Whether that'll be a, whether that will represent a massive sales bump and turnaround for the publishing industry, like, it probably won't. But I think if new companies arise that are really catering to that behavior, like putting out only a few books a year, charging more for them with the expectation that people will behave in this way, that they, depending on like how many people are involved, could have like really good margins, just in the same way people are talking about like bespoke software firms now, or like really small agencies that put out apps that are meant to get to the top of the app store and then just like go away and be ephemeral, rather than unicorns that are all in on one app like Snapchat. Part of the taste economy is seeing like the parallels between like, oh my God, what's happening in publishing, what's happening in software, what's happening in media, what's happening in fashion. These are not so different. All of them are going to be influenced in some way by AI, or at least like beliefs about what AI could do, even before AI technically has that capability. And the one commonality across all of them is like this word taste, and this concept of taste as being like not disruptible, or, you know, kind of the a bastion of human thought, like the thing that the machine cannot replicate or do. And that's eternally interesting to me.
I was just having a discussion yesterday about this notion of the curator, which I know is not a new topic, but with a curator in particular, a human that's choosing things for you or choosing things that they like, and they're presenting it in an interesting way. There is such a comfort in that, in a way that's outside of the algorithm. I have a couple last questions because I know we are running out of time, more on the general side of things. And I have to ask, because we were just talking about books, what is the last book or article that you read that you were really inspired by that you would want to recommend?
Oh, such a good question. Well, I read All Fours by Miranda July, which is getting a lot of buzz.
Yes, it is.
Have you read it?
I haven't read it yet.
I would love to know your thoughts. There is this expectation of like, is it going to be twee? Because like Miranda July's reputation is a sort of like a twee figure. I found it to be earnest without being twee. I've definitely gotten lumped in with some other books, fiction and nonfiction, that have come out recently that are sort of like pessimistic, I think, about marriage. But I don't think it's necessarily a book that's like pessimistic about marriage, but it definitely is a very like nuanced fictional exploration about like desire and how complicated it is, how unpredictable it is, and like the marriage at the heart of this novel, like not a particularly strong marriage, but I wouldn't lump it in with like divorce books. It's worth reading if you're somebody who's like very interested in like human relationships and human nature.
And I also wanted to ask you, what are you most excited about writing about at the moment?
Oh, it's funny because I did like a couple of big pieces in a row and I think I kind of tapped out. It's hard. Like, inspiration definitely strikes at unusual times for me. So, and you know what? For the last couple of weeks, I was also thinking more about what I was going to say at Fest. So honestly, I don't have anything on the docket right now. I don't have something that I'm thinking about writing, but that could change very quickly depending on the type of media that I'm consuming. And I am watching season 3 of Industry right now. I got screeners. It's my absolute favorite show and it's blowing my mind. So maybe I'll come out of it wanting to write something about it, as long as I can add something to the discourse, because I think a lot of people are going to be writing about it.
That's a boys club favorite.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about it.
Do you get most of your ideas through consuming culture in general, whether that's TV, whether that's reading, whether that's Twitter? Like, is that how you're kind of forming a lot of what's interesting to you?
Yeah, definitely. I think like also like just the interplay between various things. Like my most recent piece was like at the intersection of like literature and art and sort of cultural criticism around the amount of filler and slop that's online. So I think I get most inspiration from just tying things together that other people might not make that connection. And like, I make the connection in a strong way. And then I kind of want to like externalize it or like write a lot of stuff that's like hybrid. So it's not talking about like one book or one movie, but tying a few things together.
I mean, you did just talk about industry, but what are you most excited about culture at the moment? Whether that's like certain ideas or I mean, as you said, all culture is digital culture, but particularly maybe what's circulating online, what's sparking your interest at the moment?
You know, I'm really excited for the fall memes to start. I'm not gonna lie. I think I'm excited for like fall dressing, fall memes, whatever agenda people try to push for fall, because it's, you know, it's not gonna be Brad. You know what? Here's another thing. I haven't listened to the new Addison Rae yet. I've been saving it, but I like her a lot. So that just came out today.
Okay. What makes you like her? What's interesting to you about her?
I think she's like kind of the girl next door personified. She's the first sort of like digital girl next door. And that's inherently interesting to me because I don't think that she's boring, but I think she's occupying a very interesting position in pop right now.
And like just even her styling, how she's gone more edgy. She's done collabs with Charlie XCX and where she's done her editorial spreads compared to the D'Amelios. So
completely agree.
And even like Alex Earle or Brooke Schofield, it's just interesting to see how the first generation and now second generation of TikTok stars, how they've been managed, how they've been styled, brand deals and where they've gone. Okay, some have done music, some have done beauty, podcasts.
She's proved that she can evolve. And I think the key is just to continue to evolve and not stagnate in one identity, and then she'll be golden.
I just got on TikTok like last year, so I feel out of the loop in terms of the...
I took it off my phone. I'm probably missing stuff.
I don't think so. I was even talking to Trevor, founder of FWB, about this. Like, TikTok is not as interesting as it once... We love him. Like, it's not as interesting as it once was in terms of like subversive ideas. They had to tone it down because of, you know, keeping it legal in America and all that. So it's not what it once was, to be honest, in terms of interest.
And the shopping is so intrusive.
Yeah. So I think you did a good job on that. Last question. What is next for Dirt in terms of the biggest things that you're working on in the last half of 2024?
We have like two collabs a month through the end of the year. So, and they're all very, very different. So digital stuff, physical stuff, maybe even edible stuff. I can't tell you anymore, but I'm very excited about it.
That's the preview. Okay, amazing. Well, Daisy, thank you so much for being here. Like, you are so brilliant. I think you are absolutely leading the way. You're actually pioneering new media models, new ways for followers, for subscribers to engage. This is all very, very innovative stuff and just a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. Please like and subscribe to Context wherever you are listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.